You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, it is your partner, Big Boy. Interested in giving back to your community while making new connections in your neighborhood? Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California volunteers network that empowers you to take action, contribute to local needs, and be a part of something bigger than yourself. Visit ca-neighbors.com to learn more about how you can get to know your neighbor and strengthen your community. Neighbor to Neighbor, it takes a neighborhood. Hello.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis.
Love is gentle as a rose, and love can conquer. It's time to take a stand. Brothers and sisters, join hands. We got to let love rule.
That was Lenny Kravitz singing the title track from his 1989 debut album, Let Love Rule. Since then, Kravitz has gone on to sell 50 million records and won Grammy Awards for Best Male Rock Vocal Performance, breaking the record for the most consecutive wins in that category. Alongside his music, Kravitz has also had a successful acting career, most notably as Cinna in the Hunger Games films. Now, in his new memoir, Let Love Rule, he reflects on the 25 years leading up to his first album, and tells the story of a wildly creative kid who, despite tough struggles at school and extreme tension at home, found salvation in music. And today, I'm happy to welcome Lenny Kravitz to the podcast to share how his parents' biracial marriage and very different personalities fostered what he likes to call his Gemini soul, how his mom, actress Roxy Roker, inspired the artist in him, and how he and his dad still found connection through music even as their relationship deteriorated. He talks about the rock concert that changed his life, writing his very first song as a boy, and sneaking out of the house every night as a teenager to explore LA's thriving music scene. Then Lenny explains why he turned down lucrative record deals one after another, even though he was living out of his car, how he originally crafted a persona for himself in the style of 80s new wave artists like Prince and David Bowie, and how ultimately his romance with the Cosby Show's Lisa Bonet led him to find his authentic voice and record the album that would change his life. Coming up with Lenny Kravitz in just a moment. Lenny Kravitz is a multiple Grammy Award-winning musician who has sold some 50 million records over a career spanning three decades. Now he's out with a new memoir titled Let Love Rule. Lenny Kravitz, thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, how you doing, man?
Yeah, good to talk to you. I love the book.
Thank you.
And I want to start more or less around the beginning. Your parents were a biracial couple.
Mm-hmm.
Your dad, Cy, was a white Jewish man in the news business, and your mom, Roxy Roker, was black, Christian, and an actress. Talk a little bit about them and how those very different backgrounds and personalities influenced you growing up.
You know, they were both people that were into the arts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were both living in New York City. They were both working at 30 Rockefeller Center. My father was a journalist working with NBC News, producing, assignment editor. My mother was a secretary for an executive there. That was her day job. And then at night she would go and do theater, off Broadway, at the time before she actually made it to Broadway. You know, this was the time in the mid-60s when New York City was vibrant, the culture was vibrant, you know, and at the same time they were an interracial couple. They had their challenges, obviously. But it was a magical time, and for me, growing up that way was an amazing education because I was around not only our family, but so many different people from so many different walks of life that I had no understanding of prejudice, not until I went to school. Was that ever even a conversation? So, it was great. And then also growing up with parents that are into the arts was a great advantage because they were willing to take me out a lot. They wanted me to see and hear what was going on. So I was very fortunate that I had parents that were willing to share that with me and didn't want to just leave me at home with a babysitter. Now, of course, if it wasn't appropriate or it was, you know, too late, whatever, okay, you know, I wouldn't go. But I went to see and hear a lot of different things. And that was the beginning of my education.
Early on, it seems like you were almost predestined to go into music or something artistic because you
Absolutely.
Grew up just surrounded with all of these famous friends of your mom's, these godmothers and sort of pseudo aunties, right? Tell us about them.
Well, I always say I didn't really have a choice. Like, I mean, obviously it chose me, but when I look back at my path, I just see that every stop was monumental and again, a part of that journey that would lead me to being an artist. And yes, having all these wonderful people and, you know, godmothers and friends and, you know, that were all doing amazing work. I mean, these were pioneers in their fields.
Yeah, I should say so. Cicely Tyson and Sarah Vaughan were your godmothers. And you talk about how your parents would introduce you to musicians like Duke Ellington and Miles Davis. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to go back to the issue of race for a moment. Your family was lucky enough to live in more open-minded, tolerant places like New York and L.A., but I wonder if you were aware either directly or maybe through stories of the kind of bigotry that they must have encountered, or even when you yourself first realized that some people might have a problem with you just because of the color of your skin.
Yeah, I mean, yes, it was more tolerant than the South. You know, I mean, my mother came up from Florida, with her parents, and then my grandfather came from the Bahamas. But yes, it was the North. It was New York City. It was more accepting, but, you know, they still had problems. Mm-hmm. They still had issues. And as we do now in 2020, you know, which is hard to believe. And then, of course, we went to L.A. in 75. Mm-hmm. And my mother, you know, oddly, my mother was chosen to portray, you know, her sort of life situation on the Jeffersons, which she was going to play, you know, one half of an interracial couple, the black wife of a white man. It was the first interracial couple on primetime television. It was the first interracial kiss on primetime television, and it was a thing. I mean, I remember, you know, at that time in the 70s, you know, my mother getting mail, her co-star Franklin Cover, who played Tom Willis, her husband on the Jeffersons, you know, they used to get really disturbing mail. The show itself used to get mail from people that just could not deal with that at that time. So, like I say, it's just very interesting that she would be playing that part.
Yeah, yeah. Boy, talk about method acting.
Yes, yes.
And your mom was, in addition to being an actress, just something of a parenting and psychological genius, I think, because she invented this creative way for you to talk about your problems in a way that you might not want to or be comfortable discussing with her if you were talking to your mom. Tell us about that. Who was Ruff Ruff?
It was pretty ingenious. You know, she knew that I had to express myself and that it was important, but that I might not necessarily want to say everything to my mother. Mm-hmm. So she created this character when I was around 4 years old, called Ruff Ruff. And Ruff Ruff was a magical dog that I could talk to and tell my, you know, feelings to, and we would discuss it. So she devised this whole operation where I would have to say abracadabra, and then she would say Ruff Ruff in this voice, you know, and she would turn into Ruff Ruff, and my mommy was gone, right? And Ruff Ruff would talk to me, and she, you know, she took on this character. Ruff Ruff had a completely different body language than my mother, a completely different voice, and I believed it. And I would speak with Ruff Ruff. Ruff Ruff would ask me how I felt and about things, and would prompt me to express myself and to talk about things that I might not be comfortable talking to my mother or my father about. And then after we would have these discussions, then I would, Ruff Ruff would say, okay, we're done. We're good. You know, you've said everything you want to say. Yes. And then I had to say abracadabra again. And then instead of saying Ruff Ruff, she'd say mommy. And then mommy was back. And then it was like, oh, like there you are. And it was a really smart way for her to get me to talk and to let my feelings out.
Yeah, it's a remarkable amount of insight into how kids operate and how they think. Mm-hmm. And I guess their acting skills played into it too.
Yeah, because as a 4 and 5 year old, you know, right. You know, I'm completely believing that that's not my mother at that point.
Yeah. Now, this is sort of in contrast to your dad's approach, which was more gruff, I guess more drill mm-hmm. sergeant-like. And
yes.
You talk later in the book about that strained relationship and how he led to you moving out at a pretty young age. Now that you've had the experience of being a father, I wonder if that's given you any deeper understanding of why he was the way he was.
You know, I think even when we get older, we grow up. You know, because we grew up as kids with our parents, you know, when we're kids, we think our parents are perfect. They know everything. They're adults. Adults know everything. Adults do everything right. You know, we're kids. We don't. And then you learn that that is not so.
yeah.
But I think that for me, at least, I can speak for myself that still as an adult, you still hold on to that image of them, of their your parents, and they're supposed to be a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just like us, man. They're just like everybody yeah. else doing the best they can. They got yeah. problems and faults and all kinds of things. And anyway, it's just very interesting to have this healing and to sort of get reacquainted with my father and, mm-hmm. and be able to love him in a way that perhaps I couldn't go to that depth when he was alive. And the fact that he's not here does not play part mm-hmm. in that. And that's what's amazing about energy and spirit. And it's something that my grandfather always taught me as a child, that you can't kill energy. You can't. And he was talking about the spirit. That was one of the things he was talking about. And so the fact that my father's not here physically doesn't keep me from growing with my father or having a newfound feeling for him and being able to express it. So,
yeah,
you know, if I get anything from writing this book, like wonderful that people like it, wonderful that the New York Times, I mean, wonderful, wonderful. I'm grateful and appreciative, but the real gift, was going through the process and having these kind of experiences through the mm-hmm. exercise.
So it sounds like there was an element of catharsis in writing the book.
You know, I think through writing this book, a lot of those questions were answered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before my father died, which was about 15 or so years ago, we made peace. So we got to a place of peace. But there was still questions. There was still communication that I felt wasn't achieved. And I still have feelings about certain things, even though we were cool. And in writing this book, I got great healing in regards to the relationship with my father. I got to see him as a character because everyone in the book is a character. I'm a character. When you're writing this book, you know, you're backing up, you know, and you're seeing everybody as a character and how they're going to move around and relate and all. I mean, it's all true, but you go through that process. And I got to see him as this man who was doing the best he could with what he had based upon his childhood and his experiences and him growing up. And all of a sudden, any judgment or feelings that I was harboring disappeared. It just dissolved. Wow. And I had compassion for him.
And despite that troubled relationship with your dad, you say in here that your mutual love of music and specifically jazz was pretty much the one thread that kept the two of you connected. Mm-hmm. In fact, he took you to your first concert at Madison Square Garden. Was yes. that really the moment when you became determined to go into music?
Yeah. I'd been to a concert before because
when
I went to the Duke Ellington concert. No, but I do say in the book it's my first concert. But that was my first concert like in a concert hall, in an arena, right. in Madison yeah. Square Garden.
Yeah.
You know, when we went to see Duke Ellington, I guess I felt it was a concert, but it was, you know, it was at the Rainbow Room. You sit at a table right. and you eat dinner.
Supper club.
You know, it's a yeah. different thing. So I didn't see that as like a concert. So mm-hmm. yeah, I went to he surprised me, picked me up from school, took me to the Garden, and we went to see my favorite band, the Jackson Five. I was 6 years old. I was in first grade, and it was a surprise. And he took me, and it changed my life.
Really?
You know, I don't, if I hadn't have gone to see that show, I don't know if things would have been the same for me at all. Yes, I still would have seen other music. I still went to see James Brown afterwards at the Apollo and everybody else and did, you know, in every genre of music. I've seen so many artists and been around them, growing up with them from Miles Davis on up. But that night really did something to my DNA, you know? And so if my father didn't have the insight and the love to take me to that show, you know, who knows where life would have gone, because that was that spark.
The way you describe it in the book, it sounds like you were a huge fan of the Jackson Five. Did you want to be in the band or maybe fantasize that you could be the
I was Lenny Jackson for sure. I used to write that on my notebook.
Really?
And I used to fantasize that I was the, you know, the long lost brother, and they found me now, you know, I was put up for adoption or something. And now they found me, and now I'm going to join the group, you know, I'm going to get my outfit, and I'm going to learn the routines, and I'm going to be, you know, be on that lineup with Jackie and Tito and Marlon and Jermaine, you know, with Michael up front.
And I believe that concert was what inspired you to write your very first song when you were just a kid. I want to say that it was titled "I Love You, Baby." Was "I Love You, Baby" a pretty good first effort for a songwriter?
It doesn't get much better than that, does it?
You know? No, it
says "I Love You,
all.
Baby." That's it.
Yeah.
when you're in, you know, second grade or wherever, whatever I was, third grade, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, "I Love You, Baby" kind of does it, and yeah, this kid across the street had a Fender Stratocaster and a Fender amp, and I used to go over there and, you know, play with him. We wrote "I Love You, Baby."
Do you remember how it goes?
It was just "I Love You, Baby." It was just it. It's like, really? Oh, and then the second line was, I think it repeated "I Love You, Baby" a bunch of times, and it said "I love you more and more each day." That was it. Two lines, three chords, well, you know, classic three chords.
Yeah.
And that was it.
An instant classic, I'm sure.
I'll have to record it one day.
I think you should. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. And at a certain point, I want to say toward the end of elementary school or beginning of junior high, your mom moves out to California to pursue TV and film. Was that a difficult transition for you, going from New York to LA?
It was difficult for me at first because I was a New York kid. I was, you know, independent. As a young New York kid, you can be independent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from the time I was in first grade, I was walking to school by myself, you know. And then your mother teaches you how to take the the bus and the subway and, you know, how to buy your tokens and, right. you know, where to get off and, you know, transfer, get your transfer and get on the next bus. I mean, so, yeah. and also I was in, I just completed fifth grade and I was going into the sixth grade and my school went from kindergarten to sixth grade, PS6, where I went to school. And so I was about to be a king of the school, right? Kings and queens, you know, if you, when yeah. you got into the sixth grade. And now we're moving, what, after all that? And then I, so that was already weird to me. And then I get to LA and, you know, we moved to Santa Monica, California. And I wake up the next morning, I look out the window and there's no one on the street, not a soul, yeah, not one person walking the street. So this is 1975, Santa Monica. It's way more mellow. I, you know, where's all the people? What's going on? And then there's no subway. The buses, yeah, there's buses, but I don't know. And they run really slowly. Like they don't come every, you know, 5 minutes.
Right.
And I had to, you had to depend on your parent to take you somewhere or an adult. So mm-hmm. I wasn't used to that. It was weird. And, but, you know, then I found my way and I, you know, I learned how to skateboard because skateboarding was happening. You know, I was there for that whole birth of Dogtown, Z-Boys and all that. And then I liked it. And that was another part of my education, that whole West Coast LA Hollywood thing. You yeah. know, it was new to me. It was foreign to me.
Yeah, your mom gets cast in The Jeffersons and it ends up being a great opportunity for you because you have this whole studio backlot for a playground. And this was in the yeah. 80s, which was sort of the high point of TV sitcoms. So you had all these other iconic shows filming on the lot. That must have been this a fun time for you too.
Yeah, late 70s, early 80s. It was like Good Times and The Jeffersons and you
Facts
know,
of Life.
All in the Family, One yeah. Day at a Time,
yeah.
Different Strokes.
Yeah.
Show Facts of Life, you know, and Maude, you know, Norman Lear, man, genius.
Yeah.
You know, the sitcom king.
And you were right in the middle of it all, huh?
Yeah. I used to hang out with all, you know, I used to get into trouble with Todd Bridges and, and, you know, I'm still friends with, you know, Kim Fields from Facts of Life. And, you know, there's still people from that. From that time that I still see and hear from every now and again, yeah. but yeah, it was a lot of fun and just got to see and experience so many things. I actually remember one day roaming the lot. This is when my mom, they moved from Metro Media in Hollywood on Sunset and Van Ness to Universal Studios. And one day I was just roaming the lot and the door was open just a little bit and I walked in. And I just stood there at the door and I watched this scene. It was a shootout scene, which I later found out was the end scene to Scarface.
Oh, wow.
The one,
really?
The one where, you know, he's up on the balcony with yeah. the stairs.
Yeah.
And he finally gets shot and the stuntman falls into the pool yeah. with the, I watched really? Part of that scene being filmed, having no idea what it was.
Yeah, that so was not exactly PG.
No, it was quite, it was a lot to watch, but.
Yeah.
So, you know, you were always seeing and finding things as a kid yeah. you know, on that lot.
Yeah, it must have been a blast. And around this time, your mom encouraged you to audition for the prestigious California Boys Choir, and you got accepted. Now, they're really, I mean, second only to the Vienna Boys Choir. We're talking very, yeah. very top of their form, touring, performing in operas at the Hollywood Bowl. Mm-hmm. Did you learn things about music and technique in that experience that have served you in your career?
Yeah, I also would not be here if I hadn't met Mr. Neslin and Mr. Rogers, the mm-hmm. two directors of the California Boys Choir.
Right. Yeah.
I learned so much there about music. And also, the discipline was heavy. It was very heavy. They were not playing. This was serious. And, you know, we were being trained to sight read. We were being trained, you know, vocal technique. We were trained to sing in 15 different languages because you're doing all these operas and symphonies and they're every language, you know, French, German, Latin, whatever it might be. And my first concert was, as you said, the Hollywood Bowl. The Hollywood Bowl was the opening night of the season. It was the Mahler Third Symphony with the Los Angeles Philharmonic.
Wow.
Being conducted by Eric Leinsdorf, great conductor. I recorded with Zubin Mehta, that same piece, Mahler Third, we recorded that. with the great Zubin Mehta. I performed in about 12 different operas, Carmen. We have a helicopter.
Even on a private island in the Bahamas, the paparazzi still find you. Huh?
They're looking for me.
Yeah. You're hiding out.
Coast Guard. Tosca and Magic Flute, wow. Cavalleria Rusticana, Mephistopheles, Carmen. You know, you're doing all this work. You're around all of these great conductors, all of these great teachers, orchestras, singers. And so just being in that world was a very deep education of music,
yeah,
and taught me everything about harmony.
And you know? Later in your teens, you had sort of another education in music. During the time that you were going to Beverly Hills High School, there was sort of daytime school Lenny, and then there was nighttime Lenny, who was sneaking out of the house within his mom's car, going to clubs, smoking weed. How much of that was just you partying and having fun, and how much of it was this huge opportunity to just get out there and absorb the whole LA music scene and learn
something? It's both. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're learning how to maneuver out in the world, you know, with people, your skills of being social and dealing with people and learning how to read people. It was great. I mean, I'm very fortunate that nothing bad really ever happened to me because, I mean, I put myself out there, you know. You know, you'd end up going home with people you just met and, you know, hanging out with folks and going, getting in cars with people and just, you know.
True.
I was up for the adventure and I went for it and I had no fear, you know, moving out at 15 or whatever it was and not knowing if I had somewhere to sleep or not didn't bother me. Like, you know, I'll find somewhere to sleep. I'll work it out each day, you know. That was my college, really. You know, I started my college early out on the street.
And like you said, you were meeting all sorts of people and sometimes putting yourself in risky situations, which brings to mind someone who I think is a seminal figure in your early life. And I'm sort of amazed that I haven't heard anyone ask you about this in any of the other interviews, because I found it so revealing of who you are as a person. One night, you met this teen prostitute named Jewel, who I think had been sent over to talk to you by her pimp, who somehow thought that your dad might make a good client for him. And here was this girl who had been abused all of her life, was being controlled by this violent and abusive pimp. And you, a young teenager, decide that you're going to be the person to rescue her from that situation. Can you tell that story?
She was a young girl who was in a very serious situation out there on the street. Yeah, we met and we saw each other's hearts and I realized the trouble that she was in and wanted to take her away from that and did everything that I could, from stealing my mom's car at night and going over to the valley to help her make her escape from the person that was controlling her at the time. And I put myself in situations and I led with my heart, you know, I always led with my heart and, you know, I thought things through to some extent, but regardless of the danger that I could be in, I wasn't concerned with that.
Yeah. You really rescued her, I think.
Yeah. And then brought her, you know, she ended up living under my bed and being, you know, it was a thing. It was a lot of effort. Yeah. It was a lot of maneuvering to not have your parents figure this out, you know, that you're doing, you have this whole other life and you've got somebody living in your room under your bed. I mean, it was a lot, but, you know, it was an experience and, you know, part of my life.
Yeah, it really is unbelievable. And I should point out that you never slept with her. You never even tried to. You wanted to be the one person who wasn't trying to use her and who she could feel safe around. You did this purely out of a sense of love, kindness, and decency. That's amazing. And now, I kind of detoured from your music career for a minute, but I want to talk about the development of your early musical style. Some of your fans might be a little bit surprised to hear that your musical heroes in those days were Prince and David Bowie, and you fashioned yourself in the 80s new wave style, dropping your name and taking on a new persona as Romeo Blue. Who was Romeo Blue?
He was just a guy trying to figure it out. You know, I didn't think that my name was right. And, you know, I was trying to find myself. So you start putting on all these different costumes and faces and personas. And some friends gave me the nickname Romeo. And then I added the blue to it, which came from Adrian Belew, the guitarist, which he spells it B-E-L-E-W, I believe. And I like the way that sounded, Belew, but then I just made it Blue. And so I became Romeo Blue, and I made music under that name. And, you know, it was an interesting exercise. And what was great about that exercise was that taking myself from me and becoming essentially someone else, it led me right back to me being able to accept myself for who I was, because I didn't feel right with this. I mean, it was fun, it was cool, but I didn't feel comfortable with it in the end. So I went back to being myself. So, that was a good exercise.
And even in that moment, when you were taking on this whole persona of Romeo Blue, it still sounds like you had a certain sense of self and what kind of artist you wanted to be that maybe hadn't been fully formed or hadn't emerged yet. But you start getting these serious offers from major record labels one after another. And even though you're living in your car and couch surfing, you're turning them all down. I have to wonder, how did you have the confidence to know yourself like that and to know that those opportunities weren't ultimately right for you?
It was my spirit talking, because I can't tell anyone to this day how I had the strength to do that.
Yeah.
Because here I am living in a car on floors, and I'm being offered major record deals, turning them down because I didn't feel that they were creatively what I wanted to be. And I would refuse them. And here I am, I'm walking off the lot, having just turned down, you know, lots of money and opportunity to continue living however I was living until I found what I found. Now, what else is interesting about that, obviously, is that I didn't have a sound yet. I hadn't found my sound, but I knew that what they wanted me to do was not right. So could I have taken the deal and thought, well, okay, I'll do this for now. I'll develop. And then maybe, you know, if I get a hit, then I can, you know, slowly transition into something else, which a lot of people do. Everyone doesn't get the opportunity to do what they want when they first sign, you know, they want to get their foot in the door. And it's, you know, perhaps achieve some level of fame and then, you know, do whatever. But for me, I couldn't do it. My spirit wouldn't allow me to do it. I had to be me. So I turned those deals down, and not just one, but two, three, four, and five of them, you know?
Wow.
And people thought I was crazy and stupid, and understandably so. But it all worked out.
Yeah, it did. And eventually you had this kind of turning point, both for you personally and musically, when you met and fell in love with Lisa Bonet. How did your music and even your outward image transform from that relationship?
I ended up in just a magical place. The two of us had a very magical life and love story and experience. Not only did I love her, I mean, I admired and respected everything about her. As a person and as an artist and as a spiritual being. So I saw myself in her. You know, I felt that we were mirror images of each other. Being in that place, you know, somehow opened this portal to bring on that first album, to bring on Let Love Rule.
Yeah.
Which would be the beginning of my sound and my message.
Yeah. Yeah. How did that song come to you?
You know, I was working on the album. I was already probably almost finished with the album. And where I was living at the time on Broome Street in New York in this loft, between my door and the elevator door, I wrote on the wall, Let Love Rule one day. Just because, I don't know, it just came out of me, right? And but I didn't think anything of it other than just like I was writing something on the wall. And I kept passing it. Anytime I'd come or go, you know, I'd pass it and look at it. And then one day I came in, and I remember looking at it, And I walked in the door and I went straight to the guitar and the song came out of me. And then I quickly got a cab, had to call my engineer, try to get some studio time, and went and recorded it right away, right after I'd written it.
Yeah, I think you say that writing became much less of a struggle after you met Lisa, right?
Yeah, the music just came. Yeah, music just came to me. Yeah.
And you played all of the instruments on that album. How did you make that decision?
Yeah, most of them, yeah.
First of all,
I couldn't afford it when I made that first record. So I couldn't afford to pay people because I made that record without a record company. My engineer, right. who had heard me play different instruments, just messing around, said, "I've heard you play all these instruments. Why don't you just do it yourself?" And I thought, no, that's boring. I don't want to do that, you know, but I had no choice. And so I said, all right, I'll play all the instruments. And you know, I admired people who did that, like Stevie Wonder, like Paul McCartney, like obviously Prince, Todd Rundgren, different folks. But I'd never thought of it for myself. Mm-hmm. And when I started to do it, that process, the way I worked, just, I fell in love with it.
Yeah. You still don't record with a band, right?
No, I record primarily by myself.
Okay.
And it, you know, guest on certain things. Uh-huh. It became my sound. It was not the way I had intended to make an album. I wanted to have a band. Yeah. I wanted to have musicians in the studio. I wanted to have fun. I wanted it to be, you know, exciting and have this, you know, this party atmosphere. But that's not what was chosen for me. And it's just something that you know, I don't have to explain anything to anybody. I just go from one instrument and everything begins to weave itself together. And it just worked for me. And that became my sound. So that is what I still do.
You still play most of the instruments when you record?
Yeah. All or most. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. You're a one man band.
I'm in the studio now working on a record and still doing it, still loving it, still just as hungry and excited to make music as I was when I was in high school, you know.
Plus, I imagine it makes it a hell of a lot easier to record during quarantine.
Yeah. Yeah. You can be by yourself.
And when you wrote Let Love Rule, some music execs kind of didn't know what to make of you. They said that your music wasn't black enough or it wasn't white enough. Were they sort of dumbfounded that you didn't want to be a hip hop or an R&B artist?
Yes, they didn't understand it. And they, you know, wanted me to do what was on the radio and what they thought a black artist should be doing, which I never understood because black people invented rock and roll. So I didn't understand that. But that wasn't the fashion at the time. Rock was considered white and black was R&B or hip hop or whatever, which made no sense, but that's the way it was. And they thought I was talented and that's why they wanted to offer me these deals, but they didn't want me doing what I wanted to do. They wanted to take my talent and apply it in a different way. So yeah, that's what happened until I met Nancy Jeffries and Jeff Aeroff and Jordan Harris at Virgin Records, and everything changed.
And when Virgin Records put out the album, Let Love Rule was sort of a slow rollout, but then the European tour turns the tide. What happened on that tour? What was different?
Well, Europe was much more open and not so, you know, worried about format as much as America was. And so they sent me to Europe and I went over there and did promo. I started out in, I think, four countries. I started out in Hamburg, Germany, Paris, France, London, England, and Holland. That's where it started. And I played clubs, I did press, I did radio, I did, you know, and it started to pick up over there. And think, you know, then I started doing touring over there, and then I came back to America. But that's where it started in Europe.
Well, before we go, I want to return to these three little words, let love rule. I find it telling that you chose it for the title of your book, and I wonder if it's sort of become a mantra for you over the years.
Absolutely. As I said, when I found my my sound and my message, you know, with that song, that has become it for me to this day. The message will always be let love rule.
Yeah.
That is what it's all about.
Yeah.
That's always there.
A great message, great song, and a great book.
You.
Again,
thank
the book
you,
is called Let Love Rule. Lenny Kravitz, thanks again.
It's a pleasure speaking with you today, man. I enjoyed that. Thank you, man.
Thanks again to Lenny Kravitz for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, Let Love Rule, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. and follow him at LennyKravitz.com or on Twitter at @LennyKravitz. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.